This is tape number 4 of an interview with Dr. Clinton Ann Woolsey, Professor Emeritus of Neurophysiology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This portion of the interview was conducted in Dr. Woolsey's office at the Weissman Center on February 25th, 1982, by Calvin Pierce. Working on the National Research Council.
Well, is it on now?
Yes.
This was just to be a brief discussion of the various advisory committees that we've served on over the years, beginning in 1952 when we were appointed the representative of the American Neurological Association to the National Research Council of the Division of Medical Sciences. And at that same time, I also was appointed special consultant to the NIMH, which was the National Institute of Mental Health. And during the very first year we were on that committee, a new institute was established, namely the Neurological Diseases and Blindness Institute. And part of the committee which had been considering applications to the NIMH, which would naturally fall within the area of the National Institutes of Neurological Diseases and Blindness Institute, we were put on the same kind of a committee. In other words, we left the committee for the National Institute of Mental Health and went on the committee for the Neurological Diseases and Blindness Institute. And so we continued on in that realm through that would be for 6 years, through 1958. And then for the next 4 years, we were a member of the National Advisory Council of the NINDB. It seems to me that's the same thing, but I don't think it is. And
you must have just had a different higher level.
Well, there are several different committees, you see, and the don't quite remember the status of the. I think it's the same thing. Yes, it was. That's see the special consultant of in 1953-56 was the Neurological Disease and Blindness Institute, and 1957-58 is also the same institute.
Mm-hmm. What were you mainly doing? What were your responsibilities there?
The responsibilities were to review grant applications that come, and then they'd send them to you. You'd have to review them, write out opinions, and then appear at the meeting of the committee in Washington 2 to 3 times a year to pass upon these and make recommendations to the institute as to what they should or should not support.
So you had a fairly good idea, I suppose, of what was going on.
You had a good idea what was going on across the country, right?
Uh-huh.
And you got to know many people. You often had to go make site visits to determine whether you. I think very frequently we made site visits. It became more frequent later than it was in the beginning as the problem increased and there were many more people seeking support. So they sometimes had to send out teams to look over the facilities and consult the discuss their projects with the people. Sometimes there were two-day long meetings. So it was quite a job.
And in that later period there, tell me how you got involved with this medical exchange mission to the USSR.
Well, let's see, what was the date of that?
58, I think.
Yes, that's right, sure, it was 58. Well, I just got a telephone call one day from Washington saying, could I be ready to leave for exchange mission to Russia 3 weeks from now? And I said, well, I've got to get a passport. Well, they said, we'll help you with that. And so I agreed to go. There's one other individual from Wisconsin who went. That was Frank Forster. He was chairman of the group. And then there were four, I think there were six of us all together, four others, from one from Mayo's, one from Harvard, one from Utah, and one from the NIH. And we went to Russia for, they said the passport would be ready when we met in Washington for a briefing, but they didn't have it yet when we went off, took off for the plane, and the passport was given to us by the Russian, they got it to us just as we got on the plane.
Hmm. And you had what were your impressions of their research programs at that time?
Well, we visited some 19 research institutes in Russia. They varied from neurophysiological and pharmacological and anatomical through neurosurgical and neurological and psychiatric. I didn't tend to go to the psychiatric institute because someone else did that, but we did visit the special hospitals where these institutes were established, and then of course the research institutes are quite separate in Russia, are quite separate from their medical schools. There may be people doing research in the medical schools, but by and large the research activities in Russia were carried out in special research institutes. We had a good chance to see their facilities, and they varied. There were some quite modern facilities coming along. I think one of the more advanced studies on the human brain waves was being done by an individual, a woman from Leningrad, who'd been in Montreal working with Herbert Jasper there, and she was doing some very nice work. There was also one individual who was not in Russia at the time; he was out on a journey somewhere else, who was also doing single unit studies, which was very early. He was probably the first to do that in Russia. In general, we were shown experiments in progress and told what was being looked at, what the problem was, and some of the methods they were using. But by and large, no one ever told us, if you ask them, for example, well, what conclusions do you draw? What are the results? Well, we haven't gone far enough to say. And only in one case did I find, after we'd had our interviews and read some of the literature that they handed out to us, there was only one instance in which an individual told us in detail about his results that hadn't already been published. Everyone else told us only, if they gave us conclusions, we found later that had all been published.
So they were quite conscious.
They were quite conscious of that. The chap who was who told us his result was very interested in the fact that we were on the visiting committee, because we started a terminology of for the cortical areas, sensory one, sensory two, auditory one, auditory two, visual one, visual two, and that had been started in about 1946, I guess, so that would have been 12 years before. And he had decided to use the terminology, and he was very anxious to explain in what way he was using it. And he was using it for a entirely different system, namely the input from the autonomic system, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And so he wanted to show me how he used the same terminology.
A little confusing, I think. Yeah.
It was 2 years later before he published his paper and sent me a copy. So that was one in which we heard about something that hadn't.
But his nomenclature was consistent with what you
were
using?
Oh, yes, it was all right. Because they were coming into the same areas, these other. These autonomic inputs were coming into the same areas as the somatosensory 1 and 2, for example.
There was a lot of interest in conditioned reflexes in Russia.
Yes, that was the main. They were still emphasizing conditioned reflexes and Pavlovian type of physiology. So there oscilloscopes, for example, which were in use there, the ones that they built, were about this big. They were about two inches, maybe 2.5 inches in diameter. Hmm. Well, from the very beginning, we used the 5-inch scopes. And so their most of the advanced technology that they had was derived from Scandinavia. They imported a lot of research equipment from Sweden and Denmark, and there was relatively little in terms of production of modern equipment that was Russian.
I think it was in your part of the report that you must have written where you talked about some promise of bringing together the conditioned reflexes with the electrophysiological techniques, and I don't know if that turned out to be a fruitful path.
I'd have to look that up and see. I don't remember.
Yeah.
What the discussion was there.
Well,
they did some. I think one place where there was some excellent research going on was on the auditory system at the in one of the institutes in Leningrad, and.
This question this raises about separate neurological institutes. You say that was one of the things that
all research institutes in Russia are separate from the from the teaching institutions. Although people in teaching institutions may do research, they're not a part of. In general, they're not part of the research institutes.
Now, this brings me back to the United States situation where you mentioned before that when you came to Wisconsin, you weren't expected to teach the medical
That's
students.
Right.
And not long after this 58 trip that we're talking about, the Laboratory of Neurophysiology was set up. Now, what was the rationale for doing that? Why did that happen?
Well, when I first came here, my appointment was in the Department of Physiology. And I remained in the Department of Physiology from 48 until 1960. Neurophysiology had grown quite successfully, I think. We had quite a number of new people. Joe Hind had joined our group, so had Bob Benjamin, Wally Welker, and Connie Ockert and others, and so we were the most active of the research groups in the Department of Physiology. I don't know whether this was that had anything to do with the difficulty which Dr. Humans, who had become chairman of the department, told me he was having in pointing, getting appointments to the teaching staff, because when you looked at the list of people who were on the physiology department register, there were all these individuals in neurophysiology, and only one of those was theoretically involved with the teaching program. That was Ockert when he was with us, and later Benjamin took over that role. This was the, Ockert had come, he was the third one appointed to that, or second one appointed to that position when I accepted the job here. I had the promise of the dean, as I mentioned earlier, that I could invite Dr. Rose to come to work with us jointly on anatomical aspects of the nervous system, and he would be involved with aiding in the teaching of the physiology, which I was not supposed to get tangled with, and because they wanted me to devote my time, as they said, to developing the research activities. And but Rose couldn't come, so we got another man by the name of John Barnard, and he came from the University of Michigan, where he'd been trained with the very good group of anatomists over there, and he was with us for several years when he was offered a position down at the University of Illinois, and he left and went to Illinois, only to find when he got there that the examination he had to pass in order to get onto the permanent faculty and be insured, he couldn't pass. He had he didn't realize that he had a serious cardiovascular problem when he left, and so since they couldn't give him a tenured position, he accepted an offer from Marquette University and went to Marquette, where he stayed only a couple of years. Well, he was only there only a couple of years because he then died of this disorder. Well, Ockert came then to take over the position that John Barnard had, and he was with us until 1960, when we expected him to go with us into the new facilities, which had just then been built in the Medical Sciences Building. But the anatomy department was looking for an anatomist, and they invited him to come in and aid in the teaching of anatomy. And fortunately, at that point, Jersey Rose was able to come now to Madison, and so he did.
You and Rose had collaborated it off and on.
And even while we were, in fact, he'd come out a couple of times during the summer to carry on joint projects with us. And of course, we had a number of things from the past which had still not been finished, and so that those continued. But
the decision to set up the laboratory...
Well, that Dr. Humans, I was told, went to see the Dean Elvium, who was then head of the graduate school, and to suggest, maybe he was already president, he was president of the university too, but to suggest that neurophysiology be established separate. Well, Elvium wasn't overly enthusiastic about this because he'd been the one who'd been instrumental in getting us established in the Department of Physiology. So that had happened perhaps about the time we were off to Russia. But we had also been promised when I came, we had rather inadequate space in terms of any growth. But I'd been told that as soon as the new buildings would be built, why, we would get new space in the new buildings. And so when the Medical Sciences Building was under planning, Dean Bowers called me in to get my ideas about how we wanted to develop the facilities, how much space we needed, and how we wanted them developed. And so at that stage, it was decided that neurophysiology could be set up as an independent research laboratory, not as a department, but as a independent laboratory with the director, which his job I was to hold, should report directly to the dean, and there might be joint appointments between in various departments. So that was established in 1960 when we moved into the new space, and so. When Dr. Rose came, I suppose he may have had a connection with the physiology department, but he was called professor of neurophysiology, as so was I. And we had no responsibilities. The only one who had any responsibility to physiology was, by that time, it would have been Bob Benjamin, and who took over the role that Ockert had had as a teacher to the medical students.
I think it was soon after this that when Phil Cohen was acting dean, he set up a rule that each professor could only have a certain number of PhDs working under him. Do you remember anything on that?
I don't know anything about that.
Apparently there was some question that people were hiring so many technicians that the graduate students were not getting adequate training or something.
I not heard anything about that.
Laura Smale mentioned that to
who?
Me. Laura Smale at the archives said that that had been the case.
No, I don't recall anything of that sort. We didn't have very many technical help, much technical help anyway. They thought we were
I don't think it was specifically your group.
No.
But, it was,
no, I'm sure that we never had any problem there. We had a, well, we had a laboratory helper who aided in the sterilized packs for us and helped with the surgery, got the animals anesthetized and ready for experiments. We also had a technician, histological technician, and later she had some assistant. I think we only had two people. We didn't have, and we often had used medical students, gave them hired them to aid others. For example, one of our medical students was a very good photographer, and he did all our photography for us, and often sat in and made observations and experiments that were underway. So that we were supporting both graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, as well as these medical students who, in those days, the medical students had what they called an MD thesis. They either had to review the literature in a certain field, or if they got involved with experiments, they then could write those up for, and we had several such medical students. Austin So was one, and various other, there were various other medical students who came and worked in neurophysiology.
I've heard it said that you were good at getting grants for this program. Do you think of yourself in that light?
Well, we certainly always got grants. We had no problem getting grants for the program. We had very strong support. When, it, of course, as the group grew, the need for more money grew, and I think if I remember approximately, I think we were getting from the NIH about $600,000 a year, which partly supported salaries and other various people working there. And usually those were in 5-year grant periods. We also developed what we called a joint, paired grant, it was called, paired grant with the University of Chile, which went on for it started in 62, it ended in 1980. That's nearly 38 years.
Now this funding for your neurophysiology laboratory there was fairly broadly defined, I guess, for a while. That's what Joe Hine was telling me.
Yes, it meant that everybody in the, we tried to write a grant proposal in which, instead of each research group, maybe we'd have 3 or 4 research groups, instead of each group sending in a separate application, at that time the NIH was urging groups such as this to put in one. That probably simplified in some respects their problem, although by adding to the amount of money, that no doubt increased their problem, at least with reviewers. At any rate, we would have had several subcategories in the grant, so some would deal with some would deal with the somatosensory system, the motor system, the auditory system, maybe the visual system, and so on. Then there might be a section on anatomy. For example, Al Berman's big atlases of the brain were both supported out of the grants, out of our, to some degree, from our NIH grant.
I take it there was a tendency for the individual research projects to become more specialized and have less direct links with each other.
Well, it was always very easy to get together and discuss if there were problems. The techniques were similar in the different areas. at least they're less specialized then than they are now. Now I think there is a real problem that has developed, and that in order to carry on research on the somatosensory system or the auditory system or the visual system, you have to develop very complex equipment, usually managed by computers, but they'll be different for auditory and visual and somatic because the stimuli are different, and the equipment therefore necessary to produce the stimuli will be quite different. Of course, there was a general, one area in which there was a coming together with all these groups was, of course, in the histology lab. We had, well, I don't know how many people we had. We've got three or four working there now. We've got one out here, and we've got several over the other place. There must be at least four, maybe as many as six people working on histology. Hmm. And the general grant, of course, covered the anatomical aspects by providing for the salaries of some of them were, of course, on state funds, but others were on our grant funds, and they so that was easy to put together in one block within the grant. Whereas each grant would indicate what need he had was needed for what was needed for that particular section of the laboratory in terms of anatomical connections, but then the support for the anatomy was separated from it.
Hmm. As director of the laboratory, how did you approach the research programs within it? Did you supervise them fairly closely, or what was
within
your role?
The laboratory? No,
yes.
No. I think we. Most everyone who was in charge of a certain area was well trained and had could handle that aspect. The only time we would gather to get any discussion would be when we're putting the grant together and make sure that, since I had to finally formulate the grant and make the final copy out or writing of it, usually. They would give me the material, and I would then put it together in my English, and that's how it went off.
Hmm.
But no, there was no problem. That was never any problem. At the beginning, of course, all these people were working with me at the time they came. For example, mm-hmm. Welker and Benjamin came in the same year, and we started working together on a certain project. And then it turned out that 2 to 3 years was a suitable time to get people instructed in the methods and the techniques and the way of analyzing the data, and then they could continue on their own. And so as soon as they then figured out some project they wanted to work on their own, why, that's what they were doing. And that would then be written up for the grant application. Even when Joe Hine first came, we were had already been interested in the auditory system, and among the earliest things done was the application when Jersey Rose came out one summer of the microelectrode techniques to the auditory system, and that was done with Joe. And then, of course, the proposal for continuation of work there grew out of that. But as then each of these, so that I had my group finally, postdoctoral fellows and graduate and postdoc and graduate students. Joe would have his, Benjamin would have his, and Welker would have his. So we'd have essentially four laboratories, but we were always close at hand and could consult with one another if need be. Welker very quickly took up the microelectrode technique and developed it to the stage where now he's, as I said, examining the cortex of the cerebellum in great detail, 100 punctures per square millimeter. No one else has gotten quite that detailed.
During the 1960s, your own
studies in neurophysiology, emphasize any particular sensory modality or subject area that you tended to focus on, do you think, in this, when the laboratory got going? What was your own research?
Well, we did a fair amount on the somatosensory system.
Mm-hmm.
What was the date, did you say, 60?
Oh, during the 60s, I guess. I was thinking of.
Well, we were still interested in the auditory area at that time, but we were also stimulating the motor cortex and recording from the somatosensory cortex.
This is side B of tape number 4 of an interview with Dr. Clinton N. Woolsey, conducted on February 25th, 1982.
Well, you see, in 1960, we were giving papers on the auditory system, and we were working at that time with Dr. Hind and others on the single cells in the auditory cortex. That's when the work began here. We also, when Dr. Dalman came from London, we worked on the auditory system of the cat, working out the connections from the nerve to the cortex and then the interconnections at the cortical levels. That was the beginning of that type of work here. But we were working on chimpanzees and gibbons, and we also began doing work on the projections of the thalamus to the various subdivisions of the auditory cortex, and so we were still. We also had done some work on the cerebellum at that period too. Mm-hmm. So. It was fairly broad,
mm-hmm.
And that's perhaps one difference between what we were doing in the beginnings when we first came here and what's now going on. Now everybody's settled down, and that again is entangled with this very high specialization of the equipment.
Mm.
We still need to have people working on more than one system and with more than one technique of one method of sensory stimulation, because all too many studies that have been made on the cortex have used either, say, the visual, the auditory, or the somatic. The idea of the beginning was that these were all separated,
mm-hmm.
and therefore you could work with, you're working on a somatosensory system, you'll use somatic stimuli. It's coming out now with these multiple areas which have been found, that some of these areas at least, and maybe more than has been thought, are getting input from more than one system. And so a great disadvantage that now exists, if anyone has established a laboratory in which he's prepared to study the auditory system and not to study the other system, or to study the visual or the somatic instead of any other, he's not in a position to readily use more than one method of stimulation. And I think the thing that's going to have to be done in the future is to either have the different groups that are specialized in each of these directions come together on a given experiment and work together to try so they can use the different techniques in the study of a given area of the brain.
Sort of a team research.
Team research.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is likely to happen. Or the alternative would be for a given laboratory to equip itself to do all three of these things. And that would be a little difficult, expensive expense-wise, and it might also be difficult to keep it all in operating condition for any one individual to do it.
Hmm. Well, on this question of specialization, I suppose I had a question having to do with the foundation of institutes, neurological institutes. And did you know Elliot Steller?
Yes, sure.
He was at Hopkins.
He was at Hopkins for a very brief period. Mm-hmm. He was at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, I have in any case a statement that he made where he felt that Hopkins had made what he called a fatal error by refusing what they wanted to set up a neurological institute there, and in his view, but that led to all the people scattering from Hopkins. Do you think that's what happened? Why Rose ended up here?
They have a department now of neuroscience, mm-hmm. there, but the Department of Physiology was essentially a Department of Neurophysiology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what he's referring to there. You know, the Montreal Neurological Institute, before it was founded, and some effort had been made to establish a neurological institute, a clinical neurological institute, at Hopkins with neurosurgery. There was no department of neurology at Hopkins. They had a very strong department of psychiatry, and they had a strong neurosurgical group. Unfortunately, the neurosurgeon and the psychiatrist never seemed to get along together.
Mm-hmm.
And whose fault that was, I do not know, but Adolf Meyer was probably the leading psychiatrist in the country. I think this ought to be checked because I'm not quite sure about the facts, but I think that there was an effort made to persuade the Rockefeller Foundation to provide funds to establish a neurological institute. It probably would not have included, at least immediately, the basic sciences of anatomy and physiology, because they did establish an institute of that sort. The Rockefeller Foundation provided the money that established the Montreal Neurological Institute. And Penfield, who was the person who was made head of that, while he'd been a graduate of Hopkins, he trained at Hopkins, and he trained in Europe, he probably would not have been, it would have been difficult for him to be established at Hopkins because the neurosurgeon Dandy was still quite young, and he was quite outstanding. So I think it's probably a matter of finding the people who could work together to establish a place there, and maybe that had, I doubt though that caused anybody to be distributed throughout the country. I don't think I would agree with Steller.
Mm-hmm.
I'd forgotten, he worked in our lab once in Baltimore for a very brief period. I'd sort of forgotten mm-hmm. about that. He was out on the Honeywell campus, I think in the Department of Psychology,
mm-hmm.
and he used to come over to the physiology department to see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have conversation with him, or did
you? No, I read a quotation attributed to him, and he had specifically mentioned you and Woolsey, and maybe others as having gone to other places because of.
Oh, that's not true.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe someone misinterpreted what he said.
I don't think it was any more of that than that. If you take this long list of names we've got here.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't possibly keep all these people here, you see, but they're scattered now all over the country, all over the world. People who worked here in neurophysiology. Well, Rose came here late. He was invited to come when I first came, as I mentioned before. and Bard still had a strong, after we left, why he had, Brooks left likewise at the same time, perhaps a few months earlier. He was invited to come up, go up to New York to the, what was known as the, is now known as the Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. And he went up there to head the Department of Physiology. Trying to think what the name of the school was before it was named the Institute of State University of New York, Downstate Center. At any rate, he left then, and I left the next year. Rose might have left, but his wife got a job at Goucher and didn't leave. Mountcastle was already there, and everything was going along fine. So I don't think there was any, I mean, that's just one of the things that happens in science, that is, people get invited to move elsewhere, and I suppose they'd be disappointed if they never got any offer to go anywhere else, even if they say, no, I'm not going. But I don't believe that. Where, I'd like to see that. Where did you see that?
Well, it's in a review article, historical article. I'll show it to you.
If you'd like to see it sometime. No, I don't.
Yeah.
Another person who left there, wasn't there very long, was Elwood Henneman, who's now chairman of the Department of Physiology at Harvard, and he's a neurophysiologist too.
Well, tell me about your interest in the history of your field. I guess you've been active in that off and on all along.
Well, not really very, I wouldn't consider myself to have any great expertness in that area, but when we came to Wisconsin, there was a William Snow Miller Medical History Seminar, and there were quite a number of people on the faculty, 10 or more, who were active in that. We'd meet once a month at somebody's home, and the host would give a paper that he had prepared on some subject. And I was invited to do that and to join that group. And as I mentioned, I think last time, we gave papers on such people as Florence, a French anatomist and physiologist of the early part of the last century. I gave that revised and gave that paper I had written on the early history of aphasia. We also looked into the work and scientific career of people like Hewlings Jackson, and I don't know whoever did Hewlings Jackson. I think that was done by Dr. Erickson, but. Hmm. I did the one on Ferrier, and went on one on let me see if I can think of his name. It's a German name. I mentioned it last time you were here.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
not Gold.
No, it's not Gold.
In any case, some of those are over at the medical library.
I don't think any of them were ever put on file in the medical library.
Well, no, there are some on, and I've found their typescripts, copies I found.
Did you find mine?
Yeah, yours on Ferrier was there, yeah.
I'd forgotten what had happened to that. Yeah. I'd like to know where that is, because I might like to
read
it again.
Yeah, it's in the third floor up there. And I guess
was it typed? Was it
typed?
Yeah,
it's typed, yeah.
I didn't realize that they ever did that.
AccurConnect and Middleton were involved in that, weren't they?
Yes. AccurConnect was the first appointee in the history of medicine here. Probably see him next month in Zurich.
Hmm.
Incidentally, if you go to Zurich, if you go to Europe and get a chance to go to Zurich, you ought to go see Dr. Knecht.
Yeah, I met him last fall.
Oh, did you when he was here?
Yes,
he was here, that's right.
We had a reception for him.
That's right, we attended that.
Yeah, that's right, you're a little fair, that's right. Let me think, maybe you could tell me what your reaction was, if any, to realizing you'd been elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 1960. Was that a surprise to you, or how did you feel about
it? Well, it wasn't so much a surprise that year because you see what you usually go through in what people go through in election to the Academy is their name appears two or three times and then the vote gradually increases and they finally get elected. But the year before I was elected, Connie Elvium thought I was going to be elected that year. And he made the mistake of asking me if I'd received notice that I'd been elected. And I said, no, I hadn't. And then he realized that, and then he found out that the vote hadn't yet been sufficient. But so that the following year when I did get elected, why, it was a little less of a surprise than it might have been if I'd done, it would all come out of the blue in one year.
Did people start treating you differently after that?
Oh, I don't think so.
The same period of time, you started getting involved in a lot of international organizations. Was that just your own initiative? How did you happen to get involved in the International Brain Research Organization, for example, or these other congresses and federations?
Well, I think I first attended a meeting of the International Brain Research Organization in Paris in 1960. And that was, I'd been invited to give a paper at the symposium they were holding there in Paris. And then they also discussed further developments in the area, and we were interested in that, so I merely joined as one of the people who belonged to it, and then we finally got asked a couple of years later if we would be willing to help organize one of these workshops for the University of Chile, in which we had already a connection, and so we did organize that one. That was the first, and
that's been probably your closest connection is the one at Santiago.
Well, then later we went to the meeting in Bangkok, to which we were invited. As a result of that, we were asked to organize the one in Shanghai, and also as part of that, we were also asked to organize one for Algiers, which we attended this past year.
So there's been quite a development in the third world countries in this area.
I think these workshops primarily were intended to be in the third world areas. I don't know whether they've ever had one. I suppose there may have been one in Russia. Usually they've been in third world countries. The idea being that this would stimulate research on the nervous system in those areas. And usually what happens as a result is that there connections are made between people, young people in those countries who want to go to a place where they can learn the techniques and get involved with research. And we already have that happening, certainly with respect to China now. And the meeting in Shanghai, the meeting in Santiago certainly fostered the interchange of personnel with South America. We had quite a number of Chileans. That might have happened anyway since we had our grant, but I think that it was helpful having a meeting there. And what will happen as a result of the Algerian meeting, I don't know. I suspect that most of the Algiers, people will go to France, because they've had long, even though they had a war with France, the scientists are still closely related to the French, and they speak French, so it's a lot easier for them to get involved with the experimental work to go if they go work with French people, speaking people. However, I do know at least one individual has applied to come to Wisconsin to work with Dr. Hind,
mm-hmm.
whom we met at that meeting. There may of course be others.
Has this involved quite a bit of traveling for you over the last decades?
Well, I think it was the trip to Russia that got me started traveling, because I think I'd never thought of going out of the country before we were asked to go to Russia.
Hmm.
But in 1959 we went back. The following year we went back to Europe, and in 1960 we went to Europe, and of course we did a lot of traveling to South America. Following the meeting we've circulated through most of the South American countries, visiting scientists at the various institutions there and lecturing at one place or another. On the trip to Bangkok in 78, we were invited to lecture two places in Japan on the way down, and visited I think four institutions in Japan. Then after the meeting in Bangkok, we went to Malaysia and lectured to the Medical Society on the neurosurgical problems, mainly on the basis of that material with Dr. Erickson. We then went over to Madras. From Madras, we came back to Singapore. We lectured in both of those places. Then we flew down to Sydney, Australia, and somebody heard we were coming and got in touch with us and asked us to lecture there. And we went to lecture to both universities in Melbourne, the Monash and the Melbourne universities. And then we went on over to New Zealand, where we lectured again at in Dunedin in the South Island.
Do you get a feeling of a community, an international community here of scientists?
Well, there are, yes. And in fact, most of those stops, the reason we had invitations to visit those places was that there are either people whom we'd met one place or another, or who had been here to Madison. For example, in Japan, one man had worked with us here. Another had visited here and had lectured here. In Bangkok, we had already three people who had been here to Madison, worked with me, and another who was actually here at the time. She didn't go back to be there at the time of the meeting.
Yeah, you've mentioned a lot of the names of the people who were working here at Wisconsin from other countries, and I guess most of those people then returned to their home country, helped do work
well
there.
Maruyama, who is from Niigata, went back to Japan, and he's now head of the Brain Research Institute in Niigata. Katsuki probably was the leading physiologist of Japan and expert on the auditory system, and it was to a symposium on the auditory system that we went to visit him in Nagasaki. And then in Thailand, one of my PhD candidates had returned there to work on the nervous system, and then two other Thais had been in training with Dr. Busey in Chicago for neurosurgery, and they both were sent up here to work with me, and both did work with us. And They are now, one is the chief neurosurgeon of Thailand, and the other is his close relative and associate of his. The man whom we visited in Madras hadn't worked well. He did work with me on one or two projects here, but worked mainly with Dr. Welker. That is Krishnamurti, and he's now head of the new anatomical institute in Madras. From there we went to Singapore, where another man by the name of Kanagasuntharam had been with us working on a special project some time back. I think in 62 he had come here from the Sudan in Africa, and he brought with him about 12 of these small, what do they call them, bush-tailed monkeys. They're called Galagos, the Senegalese Galago. And when he left here, he was to return to his job in Sudan, but they offered him the professorship of anatomy at the University of Singapore, so he went there. And he was there until this last year, when he was then offered a new position in Sri Lanka, which is his home country. Hmm. He was brought up in Sri Lanka and India, and then got his education in Oxford or Cambridge, I guess Cambridge. And so...
Do you have a sense that despite all of these developments, that the European and American researchers may pretty much still dominate the field in terms of original contributions, or has that changed?
Well, I think there's a larger body of scientists, neuroscientists, in Europe and in the United States than anywhere else in the world. Of course, Scandinavia has been very active in this field. I think we'll have to wait a while to see how extensive the research development is in these other countries. There are one or two centers in India which are doing rather well. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Chang has been active for since the early 50s in Shanghai, and now he's been given an institute, so he will be establishing a larger facility there for the doing of neurophysiological and neuroanatomical research. And Dr. Fung, who's here with us now, will probably work in that place when she goes back. Mm. And we had another one of their staff here working with Dr. Hein, Dr. Chen, and he will be very important in helping aid in the development of computer applications in research there. Australia has several good neuroscience laboratories. The Canberra University, where Eccles, who was one of the Nobel laureates, came from Australia, trained with Sherrington, returned to Australia, ultimately became head of the National University's neuroscience activities, and then returned to this, then finally came to this country, to the University of Chicago, and is retired in Switzerland now. But he's an outstanding individual, and there are several quite good neurophysiologists in Australia at the present time. Hmm. But the number, of course, is much smaller than would be in this country.
Do you find you have to, it's more likely that you'll have to read a foreign journal, though, to find out some particular thing these days than...
No, they tend to publish in common journals. I think that's true perhaps the Japanese journals are more devoted to the Japanese research, and maybe Chinese Journal of Physiology would be the same.
Mm.
But Australia has journals, but they also publish in brain research and in the Journal of Neurophysiology, which are published in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to turn this off for a second. Yes, go ahead.
I think one of the interesting things about the numbers of people who have worked is how many of them actually are in clinical aspects. And so in a way, if I'd like to make a review, I'd like to write them sometime and see if we can get have them give us any information about how they think the experience they had in the laboratory has been of help to them, or whether it hasn't been any help at all.
Mm.
But of course, in the beginning, many of the fellows were already headed in the direction of clinical, and many in neurosurgery boards and neurosurgical boards and neurology boards require them to have had at least a year in the laboratory. So that's how many of them came to be in the clinical fields. But there are others who came as postdoctoral fellows and spent 2 or 3 years with us. Some of those, for example, depends on where they came from. The man from Brazil is now a clinician, not a basic scientist. One from, at least one in Germany, is back in the field of clinical neurology. The man I just mentioned from Thailand is also in the field of clinical neurology. But then many others who are